Well, I'm very pleased to welcome to Fremantle Shipping News the author of a new book published by Fremantle Press. The book is called Father of the Lost Boys, a memoir. The author is Buot Alak. Welcome, Buot.
Thanks for having us.
The Father of the Lost Boys is also here with us. This is your father, Meshak Ajang Alak. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is the most amazing story. You are South Sudanese Australians. Your father brought you, you are to Australia with your siblings in what year?
We came to Adelaide in 1995.
So here we are 25 years later. But Meshak, 25 years later to you must seem like a very short period of time.
Yeah, it is very short, and it is a time when I came with my family and especially the children. They took up their education and I was watching them finishing the secondary school and then going through the university, and I was happy with their success.
Well, you are coming back to you. How old were you when you arrived in Australia?
I was 16 years old when we came to Australia.
And we're going to talk about the book and the sequence of events that saw you are coming here. And of course, there must have been a large process through your lifetime up to 16 and since, where you discovered more about your father, his family, your family, and how things transpired that led to you, I think, coming from Kenya in the final result on the flying kangaroo into Australia. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So we flew in from Nairobi. We landed in Harare, Zimbabwe, which was a fantastic city by then. Then we stopped over for a short while in Johannesburg. And then we landed in Perth. Then we went to Sydney, spent a night, and then we flew to Adelaide the next morning, which became our home. So it was quite a long journey.
Well, Australians are learning a lot about South Sudan in many ways, but one of the very obvious ways is through the Australian Football League. One of my favourite football players is Alir Alir. I think he's South Sudanese, isn't he?
Yes, so Alir is South Sudanese. He's from the Dinka tribe as well. So was Majak Dao, who played for the Kangaroos.
Yes, of course.
In fact, my village is called Majak, same name as him.
I'd noticed that, and I had wondered whether, like a lot of Italian migrants arrived in Australia, and their surname, for example, might be Calabria, after that region of southern Italy. So his name's taken from the village.
Yes, correct. He's from an entirely different area, but Majak is a common name. So it's a bull name, which is very common among the Dinka people.
Ah. Now, you've mentioned the Dinka people. This is a tribe, is that the right expression?
Yes, so the Dinka are the largest tribe in South Sudan. They're estimated to number about 5 million at the moment. And quite an athletic people, as you've seen with Alir. We've had many play in the NBA in America as well.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Also, your countrymen are routinely tall people.
Correct. So we are known to be the tallest ethnic group in the world. So it's not uncommon to find 7 foot men and women in South Sudan. Quite common, in fact.
Now, we're going to touch upon the Sudan as a nation, in a sense, or a country, it'd probably be a better word, created in colonial periods, particularly by the British, who were then controlling it, agreeing that there should be one Sudan, but it included a North Sudan area, which takes in Khartoum, as well as the Southern Sudan area. When that country came into being, and before so the first range of conflicts occurred, what was the population of North and South Sudan? How big was it?
The population of North and South the north was almost two-thirds of the population of the country, and the south was about one-third.
Right.
And what was complicated there was that the British, from 1920 to 1930, they were developing the south to be annexed to a part of East Africa. But later on, the British changed because of the politics. After the Second World War, the Egyptian with the British, they were trying to annex Sudan. But later on, the Arab world and the politics didn't allow that. So they agreed to give independence to the south, to the whole country.
To the whole country.
Yeah. And then they changed their mind so that we are annexed to the whole Sudan. And that was a problem. So there were differences of religion and culture. And we were developed during that time to be part of a Christian community. The missionaries were educating us and all the thing. But when the whole thing changed, then there was a reaction.
Yes. So a number of important features come out of this as they come out of your book. The colonial history with the British and then going back before that means that you've got a North Sudan, which is, I think, described in the book as Arab and Muslim in influence, and a southern area, which is animist and Christian, and totally different languages spoken from one place to the next.
Yeah, so yeah. Just to set us back a bit, so Africa was colonized by a lot of powers, the British, the Portuguese, the Italians, the French, and so forth. But before all those groups got there, Africa did not have boundaries. So countries did not exist as we know them now. So the colonials drew up what you now know as nations. So the Sudan was a colony of Great Britain. And what happened was that when the boundaries were drawn, Sudan was, I describe it as in the book as some being tiny, others being humongous. So Sudan was the biggest of them all, was the biggest country in Africa at about 2 million square kilometers, so roughly the size of Western Australia. So when the British drew those lines on a map, which then translated into boundaries, they did not consider the ethnic composition of what they were calling nations. So your sister across the river became a foreigner because the line had come between you. And someone far north, a stranger up north, became your countryman. So we were put together in a country they called the Sudan, which was a boiling pot of customs and religions and ethnicities. But overall, it had two very distinct parts that had nothing in common and did not know each other. So the north was largely inhabited by Arabic-speaking Muslim people, whereas the south was a black indigenous African tribes that stayed there. And the British said, well, you're now a country, so get on with it. See you later.
Get on with each other.
Yep. Now and that was a marriage of somebody else's convenience.
Someone else's convenience, not their own.
Yep.
And as I understand it, and you write about this in the book, there was the first Sudanese civil war. And I think that one way and the other covered a period from 1955 to 1972. Before you were born, perhaps.
Correct.
But not before your father was born. He was born just before that first civil war started, I think.
At the time, I was that during the first civil war in Sudan, that was the time I was in educating myself.
Yes.
Until I got married. And then there was what we call the Addis Ababa Agreement.
Yes.
It was signed in 1972.
So the Addis Ababa...
Can we come to that?
Yes, but it's a good time to come to the Addis Ababa Agreement. So when that happens, South Sudan gets autonomy.
That's correct.
Was autonomy something that everyone was reasonably happy with at the time, Moshe?
It was an agreement, actually, after the First Civil War. and Southerners accepted in order to have a breathing space. And that was a time to consolidate. I immediately graduated from the university at the beginning of the agreement.
Yes.
And that time I came back to Southern Sudan, and it was an autonomy. We were ruling ourselves, and but we were still having link with the North.
Yes.
So, and that was the most peaceful time, almost a period of 10 years from 1972 to 1983.
Now, was it, did it feel like a period of tranquility, that 10 years?
It was.
It was.
At that time, I was a teacher of mathematics in one of the secondary school in the South called Rumbek.
Now, what your book does is tell this story about your father as an educator. There's later conflict, and there are guns and there are military, but he's been driven by educating people as a basic requirement for a society to work. Is that a fair way of putting it?
Yes, that's correct. So my dad was chosen by his father and sent to school when he was quite young. His dad hoping he would make a really good translator when they tell with the British. But also, apparently, all the naughty boys got sent away to school because they would make it there. But my dad then saw the value of education, and he saw education as an integral part of our struggle. So while many saw the use of the gun as the first option, dad also saw the use of the pen as critical to our struggle. And he resolved to educate as many people as he could. And that's when he became an educator, and it became his lifelong mission to educate as many people as he can, because he saw education as a tool, and essentially that's how the British were able to conquer our land, is because they were more sophisticated in technology and other things. So that to take charge of our own destiny, we had to get an education, and that's something he's been pursuing ever since.
And you and your siblings are the great beneficiaries of your father's vision in that regard.
Yes, absolutely. We landed here in Australia with the clothes on our back and not much education, but we worked hard, and through the pain we've been able to take charge of our own destiny, having permanent work, owning our own homes, contributing to society, you know, via the tax system.
Yes.
So, which is great. So it's almost a vindication of my dad's long-held belief, and all his struggles,
yes,
that the pain was able to transform our lives.
So the Second Sudanese War, as Meshach has just said, started in 1983.
Yes.
And it goes right through to what,
2005.
And it's in the course of that Second Sudanese Civil War that this book, the essence of this book, is really set, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
So the soldiers in the north are coming down to deal with the insurrection of the South Sudanese. But the South Sudanese, as I understand it, but you're going to explain this to us all a little more clearly in a moment, is brought about because the north, despite the autonomy given to the south after the Addis Ababa agreement, the president up there unilaterally says that everyone now has to speak Arabic and everyone has to become Muslim, which isn't received at all well down south.
Yes, that's correct. And since the British left, it has been the intention and the aim of the north to spread Islam, to Islamize the black population, to make them speak Arabic. And that was the cause of the First Sudanese Civil War. So despite that brief stop in war, the North was still going on with its ultimate plan of assimilating the South.
Yes.
And that is what started the Second Sudanese Civil War, when they made it obvious that this was the intention and Sharia law was going to be the governing law over the black Christian and animist South.
Now, just so we can understand this a little more, Ashok, you made a reference to this earlier. The missionaries had been in the South Sudan presumably for some years. When did they first start arriving?
They arrived in 1905, and there were the Roman Catholic, the Presbyterian Church, and American, and then there were the Anglican Church, what they call the missionaries, and then they divided the country according to the spheres, and they start teaching the people. So we were rooted, and the English was the official language of the South. So when the Muslim fundamentalists, when they wanted to control the Sudan, they convinced the president that you dishonored the Addis Ababa Agreement and you declared the Sharia law for the whole country. And the soldiers who were in the town of Bor, that is our capital.
Bor,
yeah.
Yes.
Were asked to be transferred to the north. When they refused, then they sent the army, and that is where the war started. That is when my son was being carried with the children by ankles. And at that time, I had progress. I have been a teacher of mathematics at Rumbek Secondary School from 1974.
Yes.
I got a promotion during that time to be the head of the department. Then I became 1978. The headmaster of Malek Secondary School, which was the only secondary school in Bor Town. And when the wars happened after the Addis Ababa Agreement was dishonored, I was already transferred to the Ministry of Education in the headquarters of the South to be responsible for education and planning. And that is why education and plan for the South was very clear to me. And that what brought conflict, I was insisting for the education of the children, knowing exactly the war would end at any time. But management, making use of the resources was my target. That is why I said the pain is mightier than the gun.
Yes. Now, there's a point in the Second Sudanese Civil War where the South Sudanese are under tremendous threat. No doubt fathers in particular are away fighting back at the North military who have come down. And there are really the subject of this book, the boys who are called the Lost Boys. And some people will have heard about this group, but how would you describe to people who the Lost Boys were? Because there's a point at which 15,000 or 16,000 lost boys find their way from South Sudan across to Ethiopia. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So at the start of the Second Sudanese Civil War, which lasted 21 years and became the longest civil war in Africa, many fled as their villages were razed by the government. So there was a refugee camp in Ethiopia. So anyone who ran into the bushes got the word that there was a safe place somewhere, and people went there. Some of the village elders also started to hear that there was a safe place in Ethiopia. There was a camp where kids could get food and perhaps an education. And many started, instead of waiting for their villages to be attacked, they sent their kids off. And inadvertently, 16,000 children found themselves at that camp who had either left their parents behind.
How old were these children, roughly?
These children ranged in age from about 8 to 12 years old. So they were really young kids. Because anyone older than that would have been asked to fight in the war. So it was really the very young.
And when these children were advised, instructed to leave the villages and find their way to some form of protection in Ethiopia, were they travelling in large groups? Did they have adults assisting them on the way? Did they have anybody protecting them?
The boys went there through various means. So some ran in very few numbers and found their way, you know, by asking directions. Others were organized into larger groups and escorted by older adults who then returned back to the villages once the boys had been delivered there. So many also tried to go there and did not make it. They fell victim to wild animals and other dangers like landmines and whatnot. But those that did were quite lucky to have made it to a camp in another country where they were at least safe from the danger of being killed by the army.
Now, there's a point in the story told very much from your point of view, experiencing this as a young man, when your father has been taken into custody, put under arrest, I think more in the north because he'd been there on business. When you get word, your mother, the family get word that your father has died, and it must have been the most awful thing you'd experienced at that point in your life.
Yes, it was. And what happens with war is that the country comes to a standstill. So if you're stuck on the wrong side of town, you may never see your family again. So my dad was up in the north by the time the war started. And being a teacher and a principal and an educator was a primary target. So he was arrested by the government and they announced him dead. So for 3 months, we knew my dad had died. So it was quite painful. We had to do all the traditional passage of rite ceremonies. We had our heads shaved. And my mom had to contemplate raising kids in a war zone without a husband. And me, as a young boy, I realized I had to grow up really quick because now I do not have a father to protect me.
About how old were you when that word came through about your father dying?
I was 7 years old.
Seven.
Yep.
Yes.
And I felt like an adult.
As I sit here today, having had no experience of any sort that can be compared or equated with what you're describing and what I've read, do you still have clear recollections as though it were yesterday?
Yes, absolutely. And through the process of writing the book, I took myself back, and the more I wrote, the more I remembered, the more I saw, and it was quite traumatic at times, but it felt good putting it down on the pages because I had carried this story for so long. Mm. And to me, I thought it would be good to share with my fellow Australians. I think history teaches us a lot, and this book is a historical text in a way, although it's from a personal perspective.
It absolutely is, and I hope a lot of people will read it because something that I take from your book, from your father's story and from your writing about it, is that it doesn't really matter where you look on this planet, what tribe of people, what clan, what smaller ethnic group you might be looking at anywhere, lots of people are put under some sort of oppression, that they are marginalized, that there are so often majority groups where the minorities are oppressed, however you want to put that, and that there's a human rights story going on everywhere on the planet as we sit here talking. And I didn't know the detailed story about South Sudan, and I read this book and suddenly realize that you, the two of you, went through all of this with your countrymen. It's quite amazing how resilient you were. Now your father becomes the father of the lost boys because he hasn't died, thankfully. He's restored to you. We'll let the readers read the book and discover how, through circuitous means, he got out of arrest. But as we've said, 16,000 boys find their way to Ethiopia and your father becomes involved. What does he do?
I'll let him answer that.
Yeah, it was, as I mentioned before, that I was a teacher, and I found it was my responsibility to take care of those boys. Number one, by that time, the movement, the guerrilla government didn't need them seriously because there was no problem of manpower. There were a lot of volunteers. So they were looking at them as some kind of a reserve. And when I got in, it was very good because I was supported to be with the children. So I started the education and I continued organizing them when we were forced out of Ethiopia. And you know what happened in Sudan and was happening in Ethiopia and in other countries. The problem was that whenever there are people who are discontented, they run to the other country and then they get the support. So what was happening between Sudan and Ethiopia was a tit for tat. The Sudanese were supporting the rebel from Ethiopia, and we were being supported by Ethiopia. When those who were being supported by the Arab world overthrew the government of Mengistu Haile Mariam, then we were pulled out. And that is the time I started with the Long March.
So this is the Long March. You know, one goes and reads all sorts of revolutionary accounts. Chairman Mao went on a very long march too, but you had 16,000 boys. I've been trying to just take this into my head. And, you know, the Christians will think of Moses leading his people out of Egypt and going through rivers. And you finished up doing all of these things. You're being chased out by the Ethiopian rebels who sympathized and supported by North Sudan. You have to get out, and you have to get out quickly. At the same time, the North Sudanese military is well equipped. They've got helicopters, planes, they've got intelligence. They can probably just see where these groups of humans, boys, their leaders, their father is, and they can drop bombs on you. And to add to this, what you mentioned earlier, that this is a country, South Sudan, where it's not an enclosed game park with lions and hyenas that are there just for tourists to look at. There are wild animals that'll take stragglers and have them for breakfast. How does it work there? What sort of wild animals were these boys having to move out of Ethiopia back to South Sudan, and eventually, as we'll get to it in a moment, to Kenya? What are the traps? What are the dangers?
There were dangers from all sides, as it were. So basically, the Lost Boys were organized into groups. So Dad's a really good planner. So they were almost moving with military efficacy, as it were. But leaving Ethiopia was the rainy season. So there are no cars, so forget. Everybody's on foot with everything they can carry.
And this is a marshy countryside too, isn't it?
Yes, correct. So it's marshy, there's jungle, there's some open areas, but it's just mud and rain. And every boy carries all they can walking barefoot. And at that stage, there's 20,000 now. So it's a trail that is about 10Ks long. And some fall down and break bones. Anyone that was struggling obviously attracted the wild animals. And you might have seen this on David Attenborough, but that is the area where that mass migration happens. So the movement of tens of thousands of people awakens the jungle. And all of a sudden, the predators are coming for an easy meal. Because believe it or not, we're the easiest thing to catch as humans, and especially being young boys. So the tail end, anyone that fell or got tired and exhausted and sat down for a bit, got snatched up by a lion or a leopard or a python. So this is what my dad had to deal with. So every time we paused, word would come from the front and the back that, you know, these many boys had been taken by wild animals, or someone got malaria and had just died. And all they could do was just bury whoever had died and move on as soon as they can. And to add to that as well, we had treacherous rivers to cross. So
Can I just ask you to pause there for a moment? Yeah. For this reason, I wanted to ask you about this mighty river that you had to get across. This is leaving Ethiopia and moving back into South Sudan, isn't it?
Yes, correct.
And you've got a large number at that point, probably about the 16,000. They have to be ferried across this river. When I get to that part of the story, I've got the movie in my mind, and I think this is the central part of the movie. But very difficult to get across. It's a fast-moving river. There aren't many easy places to cross, and in fact, there are some mishaps. But describe how this great contingent of boys, your father, you, get across.
Yes, so after working for a while, we came to the edge of a river called the Gila River. So this sits at the boundary of South Sudan and Ethiopia. And we had to cross that river because the Ethiopian rebels were on our tail. Luckily, because of the mud and the rain, they could not bring their vehicles. So they had to get off and chase us, as it were, on foot. So when we got to the river, it was the rainy season. The river was bursting, was flowing fast. So Dad borrowed some canoes from the South Sudanese soldiers that were there, and day and night boys were ferried across, day and night non-stop, because we had to get everyone across before the rebels came. And a lot of the boys got through, and when the river slowed a bit, anyone that could swim jumped into the river. Wow. Just relied on the current to carry them. And during this process, some canoes were overturned and the boys were swept away and picked up by crocodiles and lost. But also, before everybody had passed, the tail end got caught by the rebels. And basically they found women and children and lost boys sitting on the edge of the river waiting to cross, and they just mowed them down. So people who could not swim jumped into the river. Women threw their kids and themselves into the river, and obviously the crocs were already there waiting.
There are things that break my heart as I read the story, Measure, if I can ask you about this, because you've lived through most of the two Sudan civil wars. But when you read about millions of your countrymen dying, and children and women too, I think, being indiscriminately killed, it must be heartbreaking. My question is, how is it that these things happen? Why we human beings seem to be daily and never seem to learn to stop doing these sorts of things.
And this is the central part. And actually, I look at the world as a global village. And this is the main aim of this story. Why should these things happen at this time? But what I'm saying, there were times I could be stressed, and there were times I could get courage, because I have to make sure that there should be survivors among the children. And then one of the questions we you asked about the animals and
let the crocodiles out.
And then the hyenas and the others. You know, in a wartime, there are a lot of dead bodies all around.
No, of course.
And the animals come around, and so they begin to eat a lot of human flesh. And that is the easy thing they were. So they were pulling a group of people, thinking that they are at war, and then when they are hungry, they begin to snatch at that. That is one of the big serious questions which has happened in the march. All these animals were interested in the human flesh, because that was the only easy thing to get during war. Because when people are killed in the war, there are no burial and no what. People are just left at the site, and the hyenas take hold of them. So I was really encouraged to do this job, so that I knew how these children could survive. And I was very clear that there would be at least some of the people who will survive and then be leaders of the country in the future. And that is why when I hit with the education, I was not discouraged by all those things, but I push ahead with educating them.
Well, that's a nice time to have some musical accompaniment, because it heralds an important statement that Mershak has just made. Can I bring us, as we finish off in the last few minutes, to this? We started off reflecting how you left Nairobi on the flying kangaroo, you arrive in Australia, and I think people understand that there's been a considerable degree of migration from, let's say, South Sudan, by South Sudanese people who've gone to Canada, US, Australia, and no doubt a number of other countries where people have gone. There's quite a diaspora of South Sudanese people, Ewart. I have the impression you, as a community in Australia, are well aware of where all your countrymen are, both here and elsewhere. Can you tell me a little bit about what's happened in South Sudan, including recently, and how that diaspora deals with South Sudan today, how family relations work, and the extent to which the extended South Sudanese people support the new nation.
Yes, the struggle of the South Sudanese people paid off eventually. So in 2011, our long-held aspiration of becoming a nation was realized. So on July 11, 2011, South Sudan became an independent nation and became the world's youngest nation. So there were drums beating across every village. There were tears globally. I was here in Perth, so I was dressing up in my traditional thing and dancing. It was an amazing realization. And our hope was that finally, we could get peace. Finally, we'll get a chance to build that nation we've so yearned for. But things have not worked out as we had hoped. So since independence, we've had two civil conflicts.
Within the South Sudanese nation. There's something like, is it 64 tribal groups?
Correct. So South Sudan is composed of 64 tribes. And although the conflict is not based on tribal lines, there are still tribal fractures that lend themselves to the conflict. But of course, we as the people of South Sudan got really good over 21 years of war at fighting and winning. But once we got our nation, we were left with a skill that became pretty much redundant. So we did not have the tools for nation building, because it takes years of experience to learn how to build bridges and roads, how to put together a health system and an educational framework and all sorts of things. So unfortunately, South Sudan is not where we had hoped it would be. And the human potential outside is contributing a lot. So you've had millions of people became refugees in adjacent countries. Many got a chance to go to the Western world. So those people now, like myself, still feel a deep connection, because that conflict is displacing people that are our relatives, my uncles and aunties and so forth. So the diaspora is always working hard to try and support back home, sending money to relatives, sending money to build things in their villages. But also the diaspora has a lot of skill that it wants to take back. People that have come here, got an education, have years of experience, they want to take back. But right now the systems and the process are being put in place to enable that to happen. But the biggest drawback is that during the war, we never got the chance to acquire the skills that are needed to build a nation.
And this is where your father's entire philosophy, Meshach, your belief that you have to educate the children, they have to have the varied skills that make a community harmonious and constructive and to build their economies.
That is really true. In the Southern Sudan, there are a lot of resources, and these resources are not developed. And as an educator, I was having a belief that after we are independent, then we'll be able to make use of these resources. We have a lot of water resources, we have a lot of wildlife, minerals, and forests, and all, countless, there are so many. So I was having a belief that if the children are educated and they use technology, technical subjects, then they would be able to make use of the resources. And also the resources which are available are creating this internal fight. So the war now which is happening, part of it is political and part of it is fighting over resources.
Yes. Now in February this year, something of a peace agreement has been entered into, is that right?
Yeah, there is a peace agreement, but this agreement was intended really for the opposition and the government to come together and then have a government for a period of 3 years in order to have put down the laws, put down the reform, and then after 3 years they go for the election. But This peace agreement is very expensive. The security arrangement have not succeeded, and there are a lot of problems on the which are not yet solved. But the government of national unity has been formed, and still we hope things will be ironed out. And we believe that people will come to their senses by saying this is our country, and we have to work very hard. And the one important thing the Western world has is the democracy. If you don't have the democracy, so we are like a walking child. And I believe that we will have the democratic process where there will be election, and then have a system of government, and have a plan, a strategy, and all that. This is what I believe will happen in the future in the Southern Sudan, and the diaspora would contribute towards that.
Yes. Well, I certainly hope that all comes to pass. It would be very sad if it didn't. Just a couple of questions to finish with. You've lived more than half your life now in Australia.
Correct.
You've been back to your village or
town.
Is it still there, your town?
No, I went back in 2009. So basically a lot of the villages got destroyed during the war. So my village was destroyed and was never inhabited again. So once the peace agreement came and people started to return back, they sort of just stayed in bigger villages and hoping that slowly they'll build their way to their own village. So my village lays in ruins, and my grandfather's grave is still under a tree at the moment, at the village that I described there.
Yes.
So when I went back there, it was like stepping back in time. While the world was moving on, we sat still and fought. And that's what war froze our future.
Yes.
Yeah, which is quite tragic. But I've been in Australia now, and I've seen what a great country can look like. And I'm hopeful, as an Australian, I can go back with my fellow Australians and help. Because we've got so much talent and so much potential and so much good in this country that would be a blessing if you know, someone like me could act as a bridge between South Sudan and Australia and enable that relationship so we could learn from each other.
Well, let me conclude this interview by once again thanking the two of you for speaking with me today. And I think it's a lovely note to finish on, the one you just finished with, you, Ott, that you are South Sudanese Australian, as is your father. You understand that part of the world so intimately. Your book, which is really the book of the two of you, provides information and understanding about South Sudan, as well as the tremendous privations that you went through, the resilience you both showed, but the powerful behaviour really of your father as the father of all of those lost boys to maintain this national identity. And let's hope that what you say starts to happen, that this bridge is built between Australia and South Sudan, and together with other countries we can make your dreams help them to be realised. So good luck with the book.
Thanks a lot.
You are going to be busy people, I'm sure, because it's a beautiful story.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Yeah, really appreciate you sharing it.